though it had nothing to do with Hester. From time to time, a letter would come to the house, and from time to time, someone would open it. A few days after John the Digg's comment about there having been no letter from Hester, the missus, finding herself in the hall, noticed a small pile of letters gathering dust on the mat under the letterbox. She opened them. One was from Charlie's banker. Was he interested in an investment opportunity? The second was an invoice from the builders for the work done on the roof. Was the third from Hester? No. The third was from the asylum. Isabel was dead. The missus stared at the letter. Dead. Isabel. Could it be true? Influenza, the letter said. Charlie would have to be told, but the missus quailed at the prospect. Better talk to Dig first, she resolved, putting the letters aside. But later, when John was sitting at his place at the kitchen table and she was topping up his cup with fresh tea, there remained no trace of the letter in her mind. It had joined those other, increasingly frequent lost moments, lived and felt but unrecorded, and then lost. Nevertheless, a few days later, passing through the hall with a tray of burnt toast and bacon, she mechanically put the letters on the tray with the food, though she had no memory at all of their contents. And then the days passed, and nothing seemed to happen at all, except that the dust got thicker, and the grime accumulated on the window panes, and the playing cards crept farther and farther from their box in the drawing room, and it became easier and easier to forget that there had ever been a Hester. It was John the Digg who realized in the silence of the days that something had happened. He was an outdoors man and not domesticated. Nevertheless, he knew that there comes a time when cups cannot be made to do for one more cup of tea without first being washed, and he knew, moreover, that a plate that had held raw meat cannot be used straight after for cooked. He saw how things were going with the missus. He was no fool. So while the pile of dirty plates and cups piled up, he would set to and do the washing up. It was an odd thing to see him at the sink in his Wellington boots and his cap, so clumsy with the cloth and china, where he was so adroit with his terracotta pots and tender plants. And it came to his attention that the number of cups and plates was diminishing. Soon there would not be enough. Where was the missing crockery? He thought instantly of the missus making her haphazard way upstairs with a plate for Master Charlie. Had he ever seen her return an empty plate to the kitchen? No. He went upstairs. Outside the locked door, plates and cups were arranged in a long queue. The food, untouched by Charlie, was providing a fine feast for the flies that buzzed over it, and there was a powerful, unpleasant smell. How many days had the missus been leaving food here without noticing that the previous days were still untouched? He toted up the number of plates and cups and frowned. That is when he knew. He did not knock at the door. What was the point? He had to go to his shed for a piece of timber strong enough to use as a battering ram. The noise of it against the oak, the creaking and smashing as metal hinges tore away from wood, was enough to bring us all, even the missus, to the door. When the battered door fell open, half broken off its hinges, we could hear buzzing flies, and a terrible stench billowed out, knocking Emmeline and the missus back a few steps. Even John put his hand to his mouth and turned a shade whiter. "Stay back," he ordered as he entered the room. A few paces behind, I followed him. We stepped gingerly through the debris of rotting food on the floor of the old nursery, stirring clouds of flies up into the air as we passed. Charlie had been living like an animal. Dirty plates covered with mould were on the floor, on the mantelpiece, on chairs and on the table. The bedroom door was ajar. With the end of the battering ram he still had in his hand, John nudged the door cautiously, and a startled rat came scurrying out over our feet. It was a gruesome scene. More flies, more decomposing food, and worse. The man had been ill. A pile of dried, fly-spotted vomit encrusted the rug on the floor. On the table by the bed was a heap of bloody handkerchiefs and the missus's old darning needle. The bed was empty, just crumpled, filthy sheets stained with blood and other human vileness. We did not speak. We tried not to breathe. And when of necessity we inhaled through our mouths, the sick, repugnant air caught in our throats and made us retch. Yet we had not had the worst of it. There was one more room. John had to steel himself to open the door to the bathroom. Even before the door was fully open, we sensed the horror of it. Before it snagged in my nostrils, my skin seemed to smell it, and a cold sweat bloomed all over my body. The toilet was bad enough. The lid was down, but could not quite contain the overflowing mess it was supposed to cover. But that was nothing. For in the bath, John took a sharp step back and would have stepped on me if I had not at the same moment taken two steps back myself. In the bath was a dark swill of bodily effluence, the stink of which sent John and me racing to the door, back through the rat droppings and the flies, out into the corridor, down the stairs, and out of doors. I was sick. On the green grass my pile of yellow vomit looked fresh and clean and sweet. "All right," said John, and he patted my back with a hand that was still trembling. The missus, having followed at her own hurried shuffle, approached us across the lawn, questions all over her face. What could we tell her? We had found Charlie's blood. We had found Charlie's shit, Charlie's piss, and Charlie's vomit. But Charlie himself? "He's not there," we told her. "He's gone."
I returned to my room, thinking about the story. It was curious in more than one respect. There was Charlie's disappearance, of course, which was an interesting turn of events. It left me thinking about the almanacs and that curious abbreviation, LDD. But there was more. Did she know I had noticed? I'd made no outward sign, but I had noticed. Today, Miss Winter had said, "I." In my room, on a tray next to the ham sandwiches, I found a large brown envelope. Mr. Lomax, the solicitor, had replied to my letter by return of post. Attached to his brief but kindly note were copies of Hester's contract, which I glanced at and put aside, a letter of recommendation from a Lady Blake in Naples who wrote positively of Hester's gifts, and, most interesting of all, a letter accepting the offer of employment, written by the miracle worker herself. "Dear Dr. Maudsley, thank you for the offer of work you have kindly made to me. I shall be pleased to take up the post at Angelfield on the 19th of April, as you suggest. I have made inquiries and gather that the trains run only to Banbury. Perhaps you would advise me how I can best make my way to Angelfield from there. I shall arrive at Banbury Station at 10:30. Yours sincerely, Hester Barrow." There was firmness in Hester's sturdy capitals, consistency in the slant of the letters, a sense of smooth flow in the moderate loops of the G's and the Y's. The letter size was small enough for economy of ink and paper, yet large enough for clarity. There were no embellishments, no elaborate curls, flounces, or flourishes. The beauty of the orthography came from the sense of order, balance and proportion that governed each and every letter. It was a good, clean hand. It was Hester herself, made word. In the top right-hand corner was an address in London. Good, I thought. I can find you now. I reached for paper, and before I began my transcription, wrote a letter to the genealogist Father had recommended. It was a longish letter. I had to introduce myself, for you would doubtless be unaware Mr. Lee even had a daughter. I had to touch lightly on the matter of the almanacs to justify my claim on his time. I had to enumerate everything I knew about Hester, Naples, London, Angelfield. But the gist of my letter was simple. Find her. After Charlie. Miss Winter didn't comment on any of my communications with her solicitor, though I'm certain she was informed, just as I am certain the documents I requested would never have been sent to me without her consent. I wondered whether she might consider it cheating, whether this was the jumping about in the story she so disapproved of. But on the day I received the set of letters from Mr. Lomax and sent my request for help to the genealogist, she said not a word, but only picked up her story where she had left it, as though none of these postal exchanges of information were happening.
Charlie was the second loss. The third, if you count Isabel. Though to all practical purposes, we had lost her 2 years before, and so she hardly counts. John was more affected by Charlie's disappearance than by Hester's. Charlie might have been a recluse, an eccentric, a hermit, but he was the master of the house. 4 times a year, at the 6th or 7th time of asking, he would scrawl his mark on a paper, and the bank would release funds to keep the household ticking over. And now he was gone. What would become of the household? What would they do for money? John had a few dreadful days. He insisted on cleaning up the nursery quarters. It'll make us all ill otherwise. And when he could bear the smell no longer, he sat on the steps outside, drawing in the clean air like a man saved from drowning. In the evening he took long baths, using up a whole bar of soap, scrubbing his skin till it glowed pink. He even soaped the inside of his nostrils. And he cooked. We'd noticed how the missus lost track of herself halfway through preparing a meal. The vegetables would boil to a mush, then burn on the bottom of the pan. The house was never without a smell of carbonized food. Then one day we found John in the kitchen. The hands that we knew dirty, pulling potatoes from the ground, were now rinsing the yellow-skinned vegetables in water, peeling them, rattling pan lids at the stove. We ate good meat or fish with plenty of vegetables, drank strong hot tea. The missus sat in her chair in the corner of the kitchen, with no apparent sense that these used to be her tasks. After the washing up, when night fell, the two of them sat talking over the kitchen table. His concerns were always the same. What would they do? How could they survive? What would become of us all?
"Don't worry. He'll come out," the missus said.
"Come out." John sighed and shook his head. He'd heard this before. "He's not there, missus. He's gone. Have you forgotten already?"
"Gone?"
She shook her head and laughed as if he'd made a joke. At the moment she first learned the fact of Charlie's departure, it had brushed her consciousness momentarily, but had not found a place to settle there. The passages, corridors and stairwells in her mind that connected her thoughts but also held them apart had been undermined. Picking up one end of a trail of thought, she followed it through holes in walls, slipped into tunnels that opened beneath her feet, came to vague, semi-puzzled halts. Wasn't there something
Hadn't she been...
Thinking of Charlie locked in the nursery, crazed with grief for love of his dead sister, she fell through a trap door in time, without even realizing it, into the thought of his father, newly bereaved, locked in the library to grieve for his lost wife. "I know how to get him out of there," she said with a wink. "I'll take the infant to him. That'll do the trick. In fact, I'll go and look on the baby now." John didn't explain to her again that Isabel had died, for it would only bring on grief-stricken surprise and a demand to know how and why. "An asylum?" she would exclaim, astonished. "But why didn't anyone tell me Miss Isabel was in an asylum? To think of the girl's poor father, how he dotes on her. It will be the death of him." And she would lose herself for hours in the shattered corridors of the past, grieving over tragedies long gone, as though they had happened only yesterday, and heedless of today's sorrows. John had been through it half a dozen times, and hadn't the heart to go through it again. Slowly the missus raised herself out of her chair, and putting one foot painfully in front of the other, shuffled out of the room to see the baby, who, in the years her memory had lost, had grown up, married, had twins, and died. John didn't stop her. She would forget where she was going before she even reached the stairs. But behind her back, he put his head in his hands and sighed. What to do? About Charlie? About the missus, about everything. It was John's constant preoccupation. At the end of a week, the nursery was clean, and a plan of sorts had arisen out of the evenings of deliberation. No reports of Charlie had been received, from near or far. No one had seen him go, and no one outside the house knew he was gone. Given his hermit-like habits, no one was likely to discover his absence either. Was he under any kind of obligation, John wondered, to inform anyone, the doctor, the solicitor, of Charlie's disappearance? Over and over he turned the question in his mind, and each time he found the answer to be no. A man had the perfect right to leave his home if he so chose, and to go without telling his employees his destination. There was no benefit, John could see, in telling the doctor, whose previous intervention in the household had brought nothing but ill. And as for the solicitor... Here John's thinking out loud grew slower and more complicated. For if Charlie did not return, who would authorize the withdrawals from the bank? John knew obscurely that the solicitor would have to be involved if Charlie's disappearance was prolonged, but yet his reluctance was natural. At Angelfield, they had lived with their backs to the world for years. Hester had been the one outsider to enter their world, and look what had happened there. Besides, he had an innate mistrust of solicitors. John had no specific charge against Mr. Lomax, who gave every appearance of being a decent, sensible chap, yet he could not find it in himself to confide the household's difficulty to a member of a profession that made its living from having its nose in other people's private affairs. And besides, if Charlie's absence became public knowledge, as his strangeness already was, would the solicitor be content to put his sign on Charlie's bank papers, just so that John and the missus could continue to pay the grocery bills? No. He knew enough about solicitors to know that it would not be as simple as that. John frowned, as he envisioned Mr. Lomax in the house, opening doors, rummaging through cupboards, casting his eye into every dark corner and carefully cultivated shadow of the Angelfield world. There would be no end to it. And then the solicitor would need to come to the house, only once to see the missus wasn't right. He would insist on the doctor being called in, and the same would happen to the missus as had happened to Isabel. She would be taken away. How could that do any good? No. They had just got rid of one outsider. It was no time to invite in another. Much safer to deal with private things privately. Which meant, now that things were as they were, by himself. There was no urgency. The most recent withdrawal had been only a few weeks earlier, so they were not entirely without money. Also, Hester had gone without collecting her wages, so that cash was available if she did not write for it and things got desperate. There was no need to pay for a lot of food, since there were vegetables and fruit to feed an army in the garden, and the woods were full of grouse and pheasant. And if it came to it, if there was an emergency, a calamity, John hardly knew what he meant by this, was what they had already suffered not a calamity? Was it possible that worse should be in store? Somehow he thought so. Then he knew someone who would have a few discreet cases of claret out of the cellar and give him a bob or two in return. "We'll be all right for a bit," he told the missus over a cigarette one night in the kitchen. "Probably manage 4 months if we're careful. Don't know what we'll do then. We'll have to see." It was a self-comforting pretense at conversation. He'd given up expecting straightforward answers from the missus. But the habit of talking to her was too long in him to be given up lightly. So he continued to sit across the table in the kitchen, sharing his thoughts, his dreams, his worries with her. And when she answered, random, rambling drifts of words, he puzzled over her pronouncements, trying to find the connection between her answer and his question. But the labyrinth inside her head was too complex for him to navigate, and the thread that led her from one word to the next had slipped through her fingers in the darkness. He kept food coming from the kitchen garden. He cooked. He cut up meat on the missus's plate and put tiny forkfuls in her mouth. He poured out her cold cups of tea and made fresh ones. He was no carpenter, but he nailed fresh boards over rotten ones here and there, kept the saucepans emptied in the main rooms, and stood in the attic, looking at the holes in the roof and scratching his head. "We'll have to get that sorted," he would say with an air of decision. But it wasn't raining much, and it wasn't snowing, and it was a job that could wait. There was so much else to do. He washed sheets and clothes. They dried stiff and sticky with the residue of soap flakes. He skinned rabbits and plucked pheasants and roasted them. He did washing up and cleaned the sink. He knew what needed to be done. He had seen the missus do it 100 times. From time to time, he spent 30 minutes in the topiary garden, but he could not enjoy it. The pleasure of being there was overshadowed by worry about what might be going on indoors in his absence. And besides, to do it properly required more time than he was able to give it. In the end, the only part of the garden that he kept up was the kitchen garden, and the rest he let go. Once we got used to it, there was a certain comfort in our new existence. The wine cellar proved a substantial and discreet source of household finance, and as time went by, our way of life began to feel sustainable. Better, really, if Charlie were just to stay absent. Unfound and unreturning, neither dead nor alive, he could do no harm to anyone. So I kept my knowledge to myself. In the woods, there was a hovel, unused for 100 years, overgrown with thorns and surrounded by nettles. It was where Charlie and Isabel used to go. After Isabel was taken to the asylum, Charlie went there still. I knew because I had seen him there, snivelling, scratching love letters on his bones with that old needle. It was the obvious place. So when he disappeared, I had gone there again. I squeezed through the brambles and hanging growth that masked the entrance into air sweet with rottenness, And there, in the gloom, I found him. Slumped in a corner, gun by his side, face half blown away. I recognized the other half, despite the maggots. It was Charlie, all right. I backed out of the doorway, not caring about the nettles and the thorns. I couldn't wait to get away from the sight of him. But his image stayed with me, and though I ran, it seemed impossible to escape his hollow, one-eyed stare. Where to find comfort? There was a house I knew, a simple little house in the woods. I had stolen food there once or twice. That was where I went. By the window I hid, getting my breath back, knowing I was close to ordinary life. And when I had stopped gasping for air, I stood looking in at a woman in her chair knitting. Though she didn't know I was there, her presence soothed me, like a kind grandmother in a fairy tale. I watched her, cleansing my eyes, until the vision of Charlie's body had faded and my heartbeat returned to normal. I walked back to Angelfield, and I didn't tell. We were better off as we were. And anyway, it couldn't make any difference to him, could it? He was the first of my ghosts.
It seemed to me that the doctor's car was forever in Miss Winter's drive. When I first arrived in Yorkshire, he would call every third day. Then it became every other day, then every day, and now he was coming to the house twice a day. I studied Miss Winter carefully. I knew the facts. Miss Winter was ill. Miss Winter was dying. All the same, when she was telling me her story, she seemed to draw on a well of strength that was unaffected by age and illness. I explained the paradox by telling myself it was the very constancy of the doctor's attention that was sustaining her. And yet in ways invisible to my eyes, she must have been weakening quite seriously. For what else could explain Judith's unexpected announcement one morning? Quite out of the blue, she told me that Miss Winter was too unwell to meet me. That for a day or two she would be unable to engage in our interviews. That with nothing to do here, I may as well take a short holiday. A holiday? After the fuss she made about my going away last time, I would have thought the last thing she would do would be to send me on a holiday now, and with Christmas only a few weeks away, too. Though Judith blushed, she wasn't forthcoming with any more information. Something wasn't right. I was being shifted out of the way. "I can pack a case for you, if it would help," she offered. She smiled, apologetically, knowing I knew she was hiding something. "I can do my own packing." Annoyance made me curt. "It's Maurice's day off, but Dr. Clifton will run you to the station." Poor Judith. She hated deceit and was no good at subterfuge. "And Miss Winter? I'd like a quick word with her before I go." "Miss Winter, I'm afraid she... won't see me?" "Can't see you." Relief flooded her face and sincerity rang out in her voice, as at last she was able to say something true. "Leave me, Miss Lee. She just can't." Whatever it was that Judith knew, Dr. Clifton knew it too. "Whereabouts in Cambridge is your father's shop?" he wanted to know. "And does he deal in medical history at all?" I answered him briefly, more concerned with my own questions than his, and after a time his attempt at small talk came to an end. As we drove into Harrogate, the atmosphere in the car was heavy with Miss Winter's oppressive silence. Angelfield again. The day before, on the train, I had imagined activity and noise, shouted instructions and arms sending messages in urgent semaphore, cranes plangent and slow, stone crashing on stone. Instead, as I arrived at the lodge gate and looked toward the demolition site, everything was silent and still. There was nothing to see. The mist that hung in the air made everything invisible that was more than a short distance away. Even the path was indistinct. My feet were there one moment, gone the next. Lifting my head, I walked blindly, tracing the path as I remembered it from my last visit, as I remembered it from Miss Winter's descriptions. My mind map was accurate. I came to the garden exactly when I expected to. The dark shapes of the yew stood like a hazily painted stage set, flattened into two dimensions by the blank background. Like ethereal bowler hats, a pair of domed forms floated on the cloud-like mist, the trunks that supported them fading into the whiteness beneath. 60 years had left them overgrown and out of shape, but it was easy today to suppose that it was the mist that was softening the geometry of the forms, that when it lifted, it would reveal the garden as it was then, in all its mathematical perfection, set in the grounds not of a demolition site, nor of a ruin, but of a house intact. Half a century, as insubstantial as the water suspended in this air, was ready to evaporate with the first ray of winter sun. I brought my wrist close to my face and read the time. I had arranged to meet Aurelius, but how to find him in this mist? I could wander forever without seeing him, even if he passed within arm's reach. I called out, "Hello!" And a man's voice was carried back to me. "Hello!" Impossible to tell whether he was distant or close by. "Where are you?" I pictured Aurelius staring into the mist, looking for a landmark. "I'm next to a tree." The words were muffled. "So am I," I called back. "I don't think yours is the same tree as mine. You sound too far away." "Well, you sound quite near, though." "Do I? Why don't you stay where you are and keep talking and I'll find you?" "Right you are. An excellent plan. Though I shall have to think of something to say, won't I? How hard it is to speak to order when it seems so easy the rest of the time. What dismal weather we're having. Never known murkiness like it." And so Aurelius thought aloud, while I stepped into a cloud and followed the thread of his voice in the air. That's when I saw it. A shadow that glided past me, pale in the watery light. I think I knew it was not Aurelius. I was suddenly conscious of the beating of my heart, and I stretched out my hand, half fearful, half hopeful. The figure eluded me and swam out of view. "Aurelius?" My voice sounded shaky to my own ears. "Yes. Are you still there?"
"Of course I am."
His voice was in quite the wrong direction. What had I seen? It was not Aurelius. It must have been an effect of the mist. Afraid of what I might yet see if I waited, I stood still, staring into the aqueous air, willing the figure to appear again.
"Aha! There you are,"
boomed a great voice behind me. Aurelius. He clasped my shoulders in his mittened hands as I turned to face him.
"Goodness gracious, Margaret, you're as white as a sheet. Anyone would think you'd seen a ghost."
We walked together in the garden. In his overcoat, Aurelius seemed even taller and broader than he really was. Beside him, in my mist-grey raincoat, I felt insubstantial.
"How's your book going?"
"It's just notes at the moment, interviews with Miss Winter, and research."
"Today's research, is it?"
"Yes."
"What do you need to know?"
"I just want to take some photographs. I don't think the weather is on my side, though."
"You'll get to see it properly within the hour. This mist won't last long."
We came to a kind of walkway, lined on each side with cones grown so wide that they almost made a hedge. Why do you come here, Aurelius? We strolled on to the end of the path, then into a space where there seemed to be nothing but mist. When we came to a wall of yew twice as high as Aurelius himself, we followed it. I noticed a sparkling in the grass and on the leaves. The sun had come out. The moisture in the air began to evaporate, and the circle of visibility grew wider by the minute. Our wall of yew had led us full circle around an empty space. We had arrived back at the same walkway we had entered by. When my question seemed so lost in time that I wasn't even sure I'd asked it, Aurelius answered, "I was born here." I stopped abruptly. Aurelius wandered on, unaware of the effect his words had had on me. I half ran a few paces to catch up with him. "Aurelius," I took hold of the sleeve of his great coat, "is it true? Were you really born here?"
"Yes."
"When?" He gave a strange, sad smile.
"On my birthday."
Unthinking, I insisted, "Yes, but when?"
"Sometime in January, probably. Possibly February. Possibly the end of December, even. 60 years ago, roughly. I'm afraid I don't know any more than that."
I frowned, remembered what he told me before about Mrs. Love and not having a mother. But in what circumstances would an adopted child know so little about his original circumstances that he doesn't even know his own birthday? "Do you mean to tell me, Aurelius, that you're a foundling?"
"Yes. That is the word for what I am. A foundling."
I was lost for words.
"One does get used to it, I suppose," he said,
and I regretted that he had to comfort me for his own loss. "Do you really?" He considered me with a curious expression, no doubt wondering how much to tell me.
"No, actually," he said.
With the slow and heavy steps of invalids, we resumed our walking. The mist was almost gone. The magical shapes of the topiary had lost their charm and looked like the unkempt bushes and hedges they were. "So it was Mrs. Love who," I began.
"Found me. Yes."
"And your parents?"
"No idea."
"But you know it was here, in this house." Aurelius shoved his hands into the depths of his pockets. His shoulders tightened.
"I wouldn't expect other people to understand. I haven't got any proof. But I do know."
He sent me a quick glance, and I encouraged him with my eyes to continue.
"Sometimes you can know things. Things about yourself. Things from before you can remember. I can't explain it."
I nodded, and Aurelius went on.
"The night I was found, there was a big fire here. Miss Love told me so when I was 9. She thought she should because of the smell of smoke on my clothes when she found me. Later I came over to have a look, and I've been coming ever since. Later I looked it up in the archives of the local paper. Anyway..."
His voice had the unmistakable likeness of someone telling something extremely important. A story so cherished it had to be dressed in casualness to disguise its significance in case the listener turned out to be unsympathetic.
"Anyway, the minute I got here I knew. This is home, I said to myself. This is where I come from. There was no doubt about it. I knew."
With his last words, Aurelius had let the lightness slip, allowed a fervour to creep in. He cleared his throat.
"Obviously I don't expect anyone to believe it. I've no evidence as such. Only a coincidence of dates, and Mrs. Love's vague memory of a smell of smoke, and my own conviction."
"I believe it," I said. Aurelius bit his lip and sent me a wary, sideways look. His confidences, this mist, had led us unexpectedly into a peninsula of intimacy, and I found myself on the brink of telling what I'd never told anyone before. The words flew ready-formed into my head, organized themselves instantly into sentences, long strings of sentences, bursting with impatience to fly from my tongue, as if they'd spent years planning for this moment. "I believe you," I repeated, my tongue thick with all the waiting words. "I've had that feeling, too. Knowing things you can't know, from before you can remember." And there it was again. A sudden movement in the corner of my eye, there and gone in the same instant. "Did you see that, Aurelius?" He followed my gaze to the topiary pyramids and beyond.
"See what? No, I didn't see anything."
It had gone. Or else it had never been there at all. I turned back to Aurelius, but I'd lost my nerve. The moment for confidences was gone.
"Have you got a birthday?" Aurelius asked.
"Yes, I've got a birthday."
All my unsaid words went back to wherever they'd been all these years. "I'll make a note of it, shall I?" he said brightly. "Then I can send you a card."
I feigned a smile. "It's coming up soon, actually." Aurelius opened a little blue notebook, divided into months. "The 19th, I told him, and he wrote it down with a pencil so small it looked like a toothpick in his huge hand. Mrs. Love turns a heel. When it started to rain, we put our hoods up and made our way hurriedly to the shelter of the church. In the porch, we did a little jig to drive the raindrops off our coats and then went inside. We sat in a pew near the altar, and I stared up at the pale, vaulted ceiling until I made myself dizzy. "Tell me about when you were found," I said. "What do you know about it?"
"I know what Mrs. Love told me," he answered. "I can tell you that. And of course there's always my inheritance."
"You have an inheritance?"
"Yes. It's nothing much. Not what people usually mean when they talk about an inheritance, but all the same. In fact, I could show it to you later."
"That would be nice."
"Yes. Because I was thinking, 9 is a bit too adjacent to breakfast for cake, isn't it?"
It was said with a reluctant grimace that turned into a gleam with his next words.
"So I thought, invite Margaret back for 11s. Cake and coffee. How does that sound? You could do with feeding up. And I'll show you my inheritance at the same time. What little there is to see."
I accepted the invitation. Aurelius took his glasses from his pocket and began to polish them absently with a handkerchief.
"Well now."
Slowly he took a deep breath. Slowly he exhaled.
"As it was told to me. Mrs. Love. And her story."
His face settled into a passive neutrality, a sign that in the way of all storytellers, he was disappearing to make way for the voice of the story itself. And then he recited, and from his very first words, at the heart of his voice, it was Mrs. Love I heard, conjured from the grave by the memory of her story. Her story, and Aurelius's, and also, perhaps, Emmeline's.
There was a pitch-black sky that night, and a storm was brewing in it. In the treetops the wind was whistling, and it was raining fit to break the windows. I was knitting in this chair by the fire, a grey sock it was, the second one, and I was just turning the heel. Well, I felt a shiver. Not that I was cold, mind you. I'd a nice lot of firewood piled up in the log basket that I'd brought in from the shed that afternoon, and I'd only just put another log on, so I wasn't cold. Not at all. But I thought to myself, what a night. I'm glad I'm not some poor soul caught outdoors away from home on a night like this.
and it was thinking of that poor soul as made me shiver. Everything was quiet indoors, only the crack of the fire every so often, and the click-click of the knitting needles, and my sighs. My sighs, you say? Well, yes, my sighs. Because I wasn't happy. I'd fallen into remembering, and that's a bad habit for a woman of 50. I'd got a warm fire, a roof over my head, and a cooked dinner inside me. But was I content? Not I. So there I sat, sighing over my grey sock, while the rain kept coming. After a time, I got up to fetch a slice of plum cake from the pantry, nice and mature, fed with brandy. Cheered me up no end. But when I came back and picked up my knitting, my heart quite turned over. Do you know why? I turned the heel of that sock twice. Now that bothered me. It really bothered me, because I'm a careful knitter, not slapdash like my sister Kitty used to be, nor half-blind like my poor old mother when she got near the end. I'd only made that mistake twice in my life. The first time I turned a heel too often was when I was a young thing, a sunny afternoon. I was sitting by an open window, enjoying the smell of everything blooming in the garden. It was a blue sock then. For a young man. My young man. I won't tell you his name, there's no need. Well, I'd been daydreaming. Silly. White dresses and white cakes and a lot of nonsense like that. And all of a sudden I looked down and saw that I'd turned the heel twice. There it was, plain as day. A ribbed leg part, a heel, more ribbing for the foot, and then another heel. I laughed out loud. It didn't matter. Easy enough to undo and put it right. I'd already drawn the needles out when Kitty came running up the garden path. What's up with her, I thought, all of a hurry. I saw her face was greenish-white, and then she stopped dead the minute she saw me through the window. That's when I knew it wasn't a trouble for her, but for me. She opened her mouth, but she couldn't even say my name. She was crying. And then out she came with it. There'd been an accident. He'd been out with his brother, my young man, after some grouse, where they didn't ought to have been. Someone saw them and they took fright, ran off. Daniel, the brother, he got to the stile first and hopped over. My young man, he was too hasty. His gun got caught in the stile. He should have slowed down, taken his time. He heard footsteps coming after them and panicked, yanked at the gun. I don't need to spell it out, do I? You can guess what happened. I undid my knitting. All those little knots that you make one after another, row by row, to knit a sock. I undid them. It's easy. Take the needles out, a little tug, and they just fall apart. One after another, row by row. I undid the extra heel, and then I just kept going. The foot, the first heel, the ribbing, the leg. All those loops unravelling themselves as you pull the wool. Then there was nothing left to unravel. Only a pile of crinkled blue wool in my lap. It doesn't take long to knit a sock, and it takes a lot less to undo it. I expect I wound the blue wool into a ball to make something else, but I don't remember that. The second time I turned a heel twice, I was beginning to get old. Kitty and me were sitting by the fireside here together. It was a year since her husband had died, nearly a year since she'd come to live with me. She was getting so much better, I thought. She'd been smiling more, taking an interest in things. She could hear his name without welling up. We sat here, and I was knitting. A nice pair of bed socks it was, for Kitty, softest lamb's wool, pink to go with her dressing gown, and she had a book in her lap. She can't have been looking at it, though, because she said, "Joan, you've turned that heel twice." I held up my work, and she was right. "Well, I'm blowed," I said. She said if it had been her knitting, she wouldn't be surprised. She was always turning heels twice, or else forgetting to turn at all. More than once she'd knitted a sock for her man with no heel, just a leg and a toe. We laughed. "But she was surprised at me," she said. "It wasn't like me to be so absent-minded." "Well," I said, "I have made this mistake before. Only the once." And I reminded her of what I've just told you, all about my young man. And while I was reminiscing aloud, I carefully undid the second heel and got started to put it right. Takes a bit of concentration, and the light was going. Well, I finished my story, and she didn't say anything, and I thought she was thinking about her husband. You know, me talking about my loss all those years ago, and hers so recent by comparison. It was too dark to finish the toe properly, so I put it aside and looked up. "Kitty," I said. "Kitty." There was no answer. I did for a moment think she might be asleep. But she wasn't. She looked so peaceful there. She had a smile on her face, as if she was happy to be back with him, back with her husband. In the time I'd been peering at that bed sock in the dark, chattering away with my old story, she'd gone to him. So it bothered me, that night of the pitch-black sky, to find that I'd knitted a second heel. Once I'd done it and lost my young man, twice and I'd lost my sister. Now a third time. I had no one left to lose. There was only me now. I looked at the sock. Grey wool. A plain thing. It was meant for me. Perhaps it didn't matter, I told myself. Who was there to miss me? No one would suffer from my going. That was a blessing. After all, at least I'd had a life, not like my young man. And also I remembered the look on Kitty's face, that happy, peaceful look. Can't be so bad, I thought. I set to unravelling the extra heel. What was the point of that, you might wonder? Well, I didn't want to be found with it. Silly old woman, I imagined them saying. They found her with the knitting in her lap, and guess what? She turned her heel twice. I didn't want them saying that. So I undid it. And as I worked, I was readying myself to go, in my mind. I don't know how long I sat there like that, but eventually a noise found its way into my ear, from out of doors, a cry, like some lost animal. I was away in my thoughts, not expecting anything to come now between me and my end, so at first I paid no notice. But I heard it again. It seemed to be calling me. For who else was going to hear it? Stuck out here in the middle of nowhere. I thought perhaps it was a cat, lost its mother or something. And although I was preparing to meet my maker, the image of this little cat with its wet fur kept distracting me. And I thought, just because I'm dying, that's no reason to deny one of God's creatures a bit of warmth and something to eat. And I might as well tell you I didn't mind the thought of having some living creature by me right at that moment. So I went to the door. And what did I find there? Tucked in the porch, out of the rain, a baby. Swaddled in canvas, mewling like a kitten. Poor little mite. Cold and wet and hungry you were. I could hardly believe my eyes. I bent down and picked you up. And the minute you saw me, you stopped crying. I didn't linger outdoors. You wanted feeding and some dry things,
So no, I didn't stop long in the porch, just a quick look. Nothing there. Nobody at all. Just the wind rustling the trees at the edge of the wood, and smoke rising into the sky off toward Angelfield. I clutched you to me, came inside, and closed the door. Twice before I had knitted two heels into a sock, and death had come close to me. The third time, and it was life that came to the door. That taught me not to go reading too much into coincidences. I had no time to be thinking about death after that, anyway. I had you to think about. And we lived happily ever after.
Aurelius swallowed. His voice had grown hoarse and broken. The words had come out of him like an incantation, words that he had heard 1,000 times as a boy, repeated inside himself for decades as a man. When the story was finished, we sat in silence, contemplating the altar. Outside, the rain continued to fall, unhurried. Aurelius was still as a statue by my side, yet his thoughts, I suspected, were anything but quiet. There are lots of things I might have said, but I said nothing. I just waited for him to return to the present in his own time. When he did, he spoke to me.
The thing is, it's not my story, is it? I mean, I'm in it. That's obvious. But it's not my story. It belongs to Mrs. Love. The man she wanted to marry, her sister Kitty, her knitting, her baking. All that is her story. And then just when she thinks it's all coming to an end, I arrive and give the story a new start. But that doesn't make it my story, does it? Because before she opened the door, before she heard the sound in the night, before...
He halted, breathless, made a gesture to cut off his sentence and start again.
Because for someone to find a baby like that, just find him, all alone like that in the rain, it means that before then, in order for it to happen, of necessity...
Another frantic erasing gesture of the hands, eyes ranging wildly around the church ceiling, as though somewhere he would spot the verb he needed that would allow him finally to anchor what it was he wanted to say.
Because if Mrs. Love found me, it can only mean that before that happened, someone else, some other person, some mother must have...
There it was. That verb. His face froze into despair. His hands, halfway through an agitated gesture, were arrested in an attitude that suggested a plea or a prayer. There are times when the human face and body can express the yearning of the heart so accurately that you can, as they say, read them like a book. I read Aurelius.
Do not abandon me.
I touched my hand to his, and the statue returned to life. There's no point waiting for the rain to stop, I whispered. It's set in for the day. My photos can wait. We may as well go.
Yes, he said, with a gruff edge in his throat. We may as well.
The inheritance.
It's 1.5 miles direct, he said, pointing into the woods. Longer by road.
We crossed the deer park and had nearly reached the edge of the woods when we heard voices. It was a woman's voice that swam through the rain, up the gravel drive to her children, and over the park as far as us. I told you, Tom. It's too wet. They can't work when it's raining like this. The children had come to a halt in disappointment at seeing the stationary cranes and machinery. With their sou'westers over their blonde heads, I couldn't tell them apart. The woman caught up with them, and the family huddled for a moment in a brief conference of Macintoshes. Aurelius was rapt by the family tableau. "I've seen them before," I said. "Do you know who they are?"
"They're a family. They live in the street. The house with the swing. Karen looks after the deer here."
"Do they still hunt here?"
"No, she just looks after them. They're a nice family."
Enviously, he gazed after them. Then he broke his attention with a shake of his head.
"Mrs. Love was very good to me," he said, "and I loved her. All this other stuff..."
He made a dismissive gesture and turned toward the woods.
"Come on. Let's go home."
The family in Macintoshes, turning back toward the lodge gates, had clearly reached the same decision. Aurelius and I walked through the woods in silent friendship. There were no leaves to cut out the light, and the branches, blackened by rain, reached dark across the watery sky. Stretching out an arm to push away low branches, Aurelius dislodged extra raindrops to add to those that fell on us from the sky. We came across a fallen tree and leaned over it, staring into the dark pool of rain in its hollow that had softened the rotting bark almost to fur. Then,
"Home,"
Aurelius pronounced. It was a small stone cottage, built for endurance rather than decoration, but attractive all the same, in its simple and solid lines. Aurelius led me around the side of the house. Was it 100 years old or 200? It was hard to tell. It wasn't the kind of house that 100 years made much difference to. Except that at the back there was a large, new extension, almost as large as the house itself, and taken up entirely with a kitchen.
"My sanctuary," he said, as he showed me in.
A massive stainless steel oven, white walls, two vast fridges. It was a real kitchen for a real cook. Aurelius pulled out a chair for me, and I sat at a small table by a bookcase. The shelves were filled with cookbooks in French, English, Italian. One book, unlike the others, was out on the table. It was a thick notebook, corners blunt with age, and covered in brown paper that had gone transparent after decades of being handled with buttery fingers. Someone had written recipes, R-E-C-I-P-I-E-S, on the front, in old-fashioned, school-formed capitals. Some years later, the writer had crossed out the second I, using a different pen. "May I?" I asked.
"Of course."
I opened the book and began to leaf through it. Victoria sponge, Dayton walnut loaf, scones, ginger cake, maids of honour, Bakewell tart, rich fruit cake, the spelling and the handwriting improving as the pages turned. Aurelius turned a dial on the oven, then moving lightly, assembled his ingredients. After that, everything was within reach, and he stretched out an arm for a sieve or a knife without looking. He moved in his kitchen, the way drivers change gear in their cars, an arm reaching out smoothly, independently, knowing exactly what to do, while his eyes never left the fixed spot in front of him, the bowl in which he was combining his ingredients. He sieved flour, chopped butter into dice, zested an orange. It was as natural as breathing.
"You see that cupboard," he said, "there, to your left. Would you open it?"
Thinking he wanted a piece of equipment, I opened the cupboard door.
"You'll find a bag hanging on a peg inside."
It was a kind of satchel, old and curiously designed. Its sides were not stitched, but just tucked in. It fastened with a buckle, and a long, broad leather strap, attached with a rusty clasp at each side, allowed you, presumably, to wear it diagonally across your body. The leather was dry and cracked, and the canvas that might once have been khaki was now just the colour of age. "What is it?" I asked. For a second, he raised his eyes from the bowl to me.
"It's the bag I was found in."
He turned back to combining his ingredients.
The bag he was found in?
My eyes moved slowly from the satchel to Aurelius. Even bent over his kneading, he was over 6 feet tall. I had thought him a storybook giant when I first set eyes on him, I remembered. Today, the strap wouldn't even go around his girth. Yet 60 years ago, he had been small enough to fit inside. Dizzy at the thought of what time can do, I sat down again. Who was it that had placed a baby in this satchel so long ago? Folded its canvas around him, fastened the buckle against the weather, and placed the strap over her body to carry him through the night to Mrs. Love's. I ran my fingers over the places she had touched, canvas, buckle, strap, seeking some trace of her, a clue, in braille or invisible ink or code, that my touch might reveal if only it knew how. It did not know how.
"It's exasperating, isn't it?" Aurelius said.
I heard him slide something into the oven and close the door. Then I felt him behind me, looking over my shoulder.
"You open it. I've got flour on my hands."
I undid the buckle and opened the pleats of canvas. They unfolded into a flat circle, in the centre of which lay a tangle of paper and rag.
"My inheritance," he announced.
The things looked like a pile of discarded junk, waiting to be swept into the bin, but he gazed at them with the intensity of a boy staring at a treasure trove.
"These things are my story," he said. "These things tell me who I am."